Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast, a discussion of everything under Australia's media and marketing umbrella. I am your very jet-lagged host, Neil Griffiths, and the editor of Mumbrella, joined, as always, and thank God for this episode, by Mumbrella publisher Adam Lang. Adam, thank you for keeping me awake on this episode.
It's my pleasure, Neil. And yes, I have the advantage of not being jet-lagged, and that is my pleasure.
So I have been back in Sydney for all of 12 hours, possibly. I've just returned from the Adobe Summit in Viva Las Vegas. So first of all, thank you for manning the ship last week. I know you were doing a 16-hour day at ComsCon and doing the podcast and moderating sessions. You've kind of ticked every box there is to tick last week, Adam.
I wonder if my induction period is now over. Am I fully experienced? Oh, I hope so. It was fantastic at ComsCon last week, and also the ComsCon Awards, some really excellent nominations and finalists and some really deserved winners. We had a great time putting it on. We were really proud of the content. We got great feedback from both the summit and the awards. And look, naturally, we're always looking for things we can do better, but very, very proud of the Mumbrella team and hopeful that we get some great feedback and aim towards an even better a summit and awards next year. But it was a cracker. And look, thank you for being over in Las Vegas, Neil. It was a big ask to get you to go to the Adobe Summit, but well worthwhile. How was it?
Look, it was pretty incredible. And I know that we've, you know, you just mentioned how great ComsCon was. We've got Mumbrella 360 in a matter of weeks now, which is terrifying. But the Adobe Summit was pretty incredible. I mean, I didn't even want to think about the amount of money that went into this summit. It was enormous on every scale. It is essentially, it's technically three, but two proper days of sessions and keynotes. There were so many sessions and panelists. Adobe CEO Shantanu Narayen was there. Duncan Egan, who is Adobe's vice president of DX marketing, APEC in Japan, was there. Major League Baseball's chief operating and strategy officer Chris Marinick was there. So many names, so many people to see and so many things to catch up on. It was a very full 2-3 day summit, but incredible. And the big takeaway was, I remember I said this to you early this morning and you wanted to rebuttal and I was like, nah, save it for the podcast. The big thing obviously was, I think last year's summit was all about the rise of AI, whereas this summit felt very much AI is here and here's what Adobe is doing with it. A lot of exciting things come from that, you know, like I've written a couple of stories already on the Mumbrella website that you can read, but one thing is GenStudio is there, which is essentially an AI tool specifically for marketers. So to put it in a nutshell, and again, you can read about it on the website, it really is almost in real time creating a campaign brief while making sure you're staying on the brief given to you. But because you have the power of AI with you, you simply just kind of type it in and do it. So it almost feels like something that could or should take weeks or days, you can do in seconds. So seeing how that works is incredible. There's really no other way to explain it.
Oh, look, I think that's probably one of the precious advantages of being there and seeing it in real time. I want to throw in a couple of questions without notice, Neil. Mm-hmm. Can I?
Sure.
All right. First one, give us an idea. You mentioned the scale of the conference itself in terms of how many presentations, the days. Mm-hmm. How many people do you reckon were in attendance there?
So in their main, I guess it's like a convention center almost, they claim that there's 10,000 people in attendance.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's for the morning keynotes. That's for the end of one. So at the end of every summit, they have a sneaks program where the developers themselves will come out and present the things they're working on that may not even see the light of day. So it's you. When I say you're seen in real time, I mean real time because these things aren't even finished yet. For some reason, Shaquille O'Neal was one of the co-panelists on this sneaks preview. And I think that was really
always good for an insight.
Yeah, I think to be honest, that was more to bring some like comic relief to it because you are dealing with these developers who are creating things like, for example, there's something that they're working on And again, preface, this might not see the light of day. But if you right now, Adam, if I was to get a video of you wishing me a happy birthday and I gave you a script and I gave it to you and you read it out and recorded it, great. I can then take that script and I can change, you know, happy birthday, Neil, to you suck, Neil. And I will see you saying you suck, Neil.
Okay. Scary levels.
Yeah. Like, and again, don't get me wrong. It's the things about it are incredibly exciting and it's going to change the game. But there are things that are scary there, right? Like, you can essentially have someone saying anything you want them to say on camera.
So this is like deep fakes, and we obviously want to keep concerned about using this as a force for good. Okay, second question, Neil. You mentioned that Duncan Egan, Adobe's Vice President of DX Marketing, you know I have an allergy to initialisms, abbreviations, jargon. Is DX digital experience?
Yes.
Thank you.
And I had to also make sure, essentially, I kind of just asked around, I was like, he's essentially Adobe Australia's Chief Marketing Officer.
Gotcha.
Summarize that very long title. He's the head of marketing and you would be his best friend because he loves data. He loves technology. But just also really cool, like kind of out of the box people that you might think aren't necessarily right for the Adobe Summit were there. Like, you know, obviously Shaquille O'Neal is one, but that was more of a fun thing. But they had Delta Airlines CEO Ed Bastian there. They had TSC Bank CMO Emma Springham there. Which again, I think I wrote a story about this yesterday about they kind of did a big rebrand for the bank, which this is one of, you would know better than me, Adam.
I loved it.
Yeah, TSB Bank is one of the UK's biggest banks and they did a big rebrand last year and it featured a cute pink elephant and the whole idea was talking about the financial elephant in the room, don't be scared to talk about your finances with TSB Bank's experts. And Emma, in her talk, kind of said she knew that was going to be a hard sell with the board. She almost expected to be laughed out of the room. Not only was it welcomed, it was incredibly successful. It won Campaign of the Year at UK's Marketing Week. And they haven't looked back since. So there's a lot of cool insights into it. A really fascinating few days.
You know what I loved about that article, Neil, was in particular the board mention, because it's not often that we hear about that, get that peek behind the corporate door and say, hey, what's the board think of this? Because you know that a lot of the courage required in marketing from a creative point of view, how any campaign is executed, what media is used, how it's communicated and expressed via PR, comes back to that central point. How is it branded and what's the call to action? And so often we don't hear about what the board thought, but in this article that you wrote in Emma Springham's words was around that the board got a lot of reinforcement from that initial impression that this pink elephant gave them. And so that gave them reinforcement over the direction they were going, but also to extend the campaign. Really interesting.
And funny enough, we in our morning meeting, Adam, you mentioned Liquid Death, right?
Yeah.
The very famous US
canned water.
Guy Raz, who many would know as the award-winning
podcast, I Built This.
How I Love Built him. This. He did a talk, and he was the one that kind of shared the story. So it wasn't the Liquid Death creator itself, but he was kind of talking about the point of authenticity, creativity, and connecting with your audience. So this guy who made Liquid Death, fun little story about him. He was kind of a more or less a failed businessman. He had a lot of ideas, none of which really landed. And then he lost all his money. And then he came to the table and he said to someone, I want to get into water. And everyone said, what are you doing? Like, you're going to compete with Coca-Cola and all these gigantic brands. You're not going to win. And he said, yeah, but how about this? Instead of talking about nature and waterfalls, I'm going to talk about death. And they said, please stop. You need to stop what you're doing. But he had this idea, he had this vision of, especially younger people, they were drinking Monsters and Red Bulls and, you know, it's all these graphic images and writing on their cans. He said, if we make, you know, quote unquote, death cool, this could work. He did a whole marketing campaign. I think he made a little promo video with $1,500 and it was all just showing images of people, you know, surfers crashing in the water, people getting waterboarded with water, people falling off skis. It got 5 million views. And as of 2024, Liquid Death is made $200 million and it's evaluated at $1.4 billion.
So Liquid Death, I've seen the imagery in the cans they use. It's like a craft beer can, mm-hmm. right? And there's sparkling water, there's still, there's other versions. But one of the most incredible things to me is that, you know, there is a free version of a competitor, water, comes out of a tap. But, you know, that these guys have built a business on something that is also competing with free and built a brand that people just want to buy into. I am stunned by that.
Yeah, I mean, even their website, you can sign up to be a member of Liquid Death and they sell it as you're selling your soul to the devil. So the whole idea is you're making water cool. Even saying that out loud sounds stupid, but it worked.
Cool water.
It yeah, worked.
Very good.
But no, I mean, all in all, I can't wait to see what next year's summit looks like because, again, last year was very much AI is coming. This year was very much AI is here. Mm-hmm. And here's what we're doing with it.
Yeah. Look, the impacts are no doubt profound, right? So I think everyone has wrestled with it in their own way. We accept it's here and it's about how to use it to our best advantage. Mm.
There'll be a few more stories coming on the Mumbrella website, but again, you can check out the stories that we've already gotten up.
So, yeah, Neil, from my behalf and everyone on the Mumbrella team, I want to say thank you for heading over to the Adobe Summit in Las Vegas. Adobe did pay for your airfare and a com while you were there, but what it means for us and our audience is that insight, many of the best insights from that summit, you've made available through Mumbrella. So thank you for going over.
Well, something big that happened this week, well, not necessarily this week, we've known about it for a few weeks now, but it is official. Meta has axed its Facebook news tab. They announced it last week that in an, quote, ongoing effort to better align their investments, as well as not continue contracts under the news media bargaining code, they have called off the Facebook news tab. Now, this move was widely slammed by media bosses and leaders of major Australian publishers last month, but it is official. So, Adam, before we get into any update on that, what's your reaction to the news?
Well, I think I'm probably going to echo the thoughts of many and say, look, we believed it was coming, but it is still remarkable that it has happened. And I frankly question it on Meta's behalf. I know that's not my right, but I just wonder about the logic of this. You know, that the people using Facebook, using Instagram, they want to have access to news. I do. I'm sure I'm probably consuming more news than the average user on those sites.
Undoubtedly.
But, you know, let's say for me or for others who are interested in news, that will be turned off and I will not be prompted to consider things that are interesting to the public appetite that are called news. So that just means many topics are going to be shut off limits in those forums. So I wonder about the impact of that. Now, obviously, Facebook Meta have made the decision that that's in their best interest to quote unquote, you know, preserve their investment. I just take a different view. Now, separate to that, what it's going to mean will be interesting in terms of how this triggers a process. And that process is involving the ACCC. And really, will they be deemed to fall under the news media bargaining code? And in which case, what they must do is negotiate. So this actually isn't over. And so what will be interesting now is how the government's new process or relatively new process will come into play.
Yeah, it's funny. We reached out to Meta early today, actually, before the morning newsletter. They referred us back to their statement that they released at the time. But there was also a blog post that was released, I believe, mid-March, so probably 2 weeks after the announcement was made. And they've insisted that users can still access news through the feed tab on Facebook and publishers can still post content directing traffic to their respective websites. Here's a quote from that blog post. There is no change to publishers' ability to use Facebook and Instagram. They can continue to benefit from our free tools and products, which they can voluntarily use should they want to. Ultimately, we're focused on building the best experiences for our users and ensuring the strength of our core business. This includes our ongoing commitment to keep misinformation and harmful content off our services. So trying to look glass half full here, Adam, not promoting news at all can keep that misinformation off. You know, there was a lot of debate around the 2020 US elections where it felt like that's all Facebook was showing. on both sides. A lot of misinformation, a lot of propaganda, a lot of paid sponsored posts there. Do you think, or do you buy what Meta's saying there, that technically you can still look at news should you want to?
Yes, I accept that proposition, but it does, as you point out, have echoes back to Cambridge Analytica, its use of Meta's data to target advertising towards voters in the US 2020 election. And that has become infamous over time. And I think it was broadly recognized that people don't want that. They saw that as manipulative. And so I think that was a concern. Now, how this plays out here will be different. As I mentioned before, there's a government mandated process to follow, and we'll see how that goes. What we know from this, though, is that $70 million approximately of funding that Meta was paying for running the news, effectively to use the news in their platforms, that money will no longer be coming to media proprietors, including the ABC. And in the current business environment, we know there is cost of living pressure. We know there is competitive pressure on media companies, and that there's been a number of redundancies already. And I would say that is going to be of really strong interest to every employee in those companies, but also more broadly, the public appetite for news is, okay, if not this funding for news, where will it come from? Or even can it come from somewhere else? And how does that impact us in terms of the appetite to feed and read news? And so I think that'll be a very interesting business impact. It can also impact how people are getting their news. And so I think that impact is yet to be known. We'll see how it plays out, but we'll be watching it closely at Mumbrella.
Yeah, we wrote about the story this morning on mumbrella.com.au. You can read about it right now. Stay tuned right after this break. We're coming into another story that happened only today. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Mumbrella Cast with myself, Neil Griffiths, and Adam Lang. Adam, while I was in Las Vegas, some pretty incredible news happened. Funnily enough, it was the morning of ComsCon, and Mumbrella was, to their credit, very quick to the punch to get the story up, which is pretty incredible considering how busy you guys were that day. That was, of course, the news that Splendor in the Grass, you know, arguably Australia's biggest music festival, had cancelled its 2024 event barely 2 weeks after announcing the lineup. That was soon confirmed by the festival themselves. They announced that they had cancelled due to, what was the quote here? Unexpected events was the quote. And then Wednesday morning, again, as we're recording this podcast only hours ago, it was reported by news.com.au that Sydney's NYE in the Park has gone into liquidation following orders by the New South Wales Supreme Court. So again, Adam, before we get into it,
yeah,
yet another Australian music festival has gone under. We started with Groove in the Moo, I believe, February. We had Splendor last week, and now we've got another music festival going under. As a music enthusiast and someone who's worked in the music industry for a very long time, what's your reaction to this?
Oh, look, first reaction was a bit of surprise and being sad, you know, because I know what it takes for promoters to build a brand name that works. And so basically my first reaction was just being sad about it. And then it's the concern of, okay, there's a business behind this that is deemed, whether it's Splendor in the Grass or NYE in the Park, they've deemed that it is not within their risk appetite to go on. Like, they just haven't sold enough tickets. There's not enough ability for that business to operate. And so you go, okay, I accept their decision, of course. This is really then goes, oh, you know, how disappointing for the bands, for every employee who works in a festival, and for the punters who love going. But clearly there weren't enough punters buying tickets early on to support that business. Now, then you go to, okay, why is that? Was it the lineup? Could be. Was it a cost of living? Undoubtedly that would play into one of the reasons why people aren't buying tickets, because, I just can't make my full cost of living requirements, let alone buy a ticket. Aside from processing that, it's then recognizing that, hey, Pink was just here and Taylor Swift was just here and they knocked it out of the park. So there's still an appetite to go to events, to see music, But the festivals that we're talking about here haven't managed to tap into that appetite enough amongst the cost of living pressure. And so initially sad, and then just think about all the factors that go into it and all the people impacted. It's significant to me, Neil. And so, yeah, in the end, I'm sad for it.
It really does remind me, I was working in music media during COVID and right at the start of the COVID pandemic, and it feels very reminiscent of that, in that a lot of these events are being forced to call off because, in COVID's case, they physically weren't allowed to go on, but you couldn't get a lineup together. These events were falling over. It felt,
you didn't know if you could travel.
Absolutely. It just felt like every event was falling over. But to your point, though, it's really interesting because, you know, Taylor Swift, her record-breaking tour, she did 8 shows in 10 days. She broke the record for most attendees at the MCG. I think she had 96,000 people there. Fred Again, a British DJ, he just did a really quick pop-up tour, essentially, and sold over 100,000 tickets for a tour that really was announced 2 days before he got here.
Pink. Blink-182.
Matchbox 20. We've actually got TEG CEO Jeff Jones on the 101 podcast in the coming weeks, and he speaks a little about that, of how well these headline tours have done, but it hasn't translated to the festivals. Now, a lot of people and a lot of, I guess, the casual fan would say, well, that's just because the lineups aren't good enough. That's why people aren't going. And there is a little bit of that, because undoubtedly the fees to get these international artists are high. And keep in mind, the Australian dollar right now compared to the US dollar is not great. And I say that as someone who was paying $15 for a coffee in Las Vegas the last week. Those fees still apply for those international artists. So if it costs you $1 million to get that artist, it's going to be close to $2 million for one person. But then there's the cost of living pressure. Then there's the fact that these festivals, these music venues have been closed for years because of COVID, and they need to make money back somehow. So
then there's insurance costs as well, right? And then putting on public events and, you know, traveling stage equipment, air travel, or all the travel involved. And so, look, it's right to say that the lineup is a factor, but it's not the only one.
No. And in Splendor's case, again, they've never officially confirmed it. They haven't come out and said it. The rumor is because the lineup wasn't strong enough and ticket sales weren't good enough. In NYE, in the Parks case, it was reported that the decision for them to go into liquidation came after Kennard's Hire took legal action against the event over an unpaid debt. But it really just does feel like we're in a new sad era for the Australian music industry after what COVID did to it. Now, the Australian Festival Association, which was formed during COVID and coming out of COVID, they've called on for government support. They're calling this, it is officially a music industry crisis. Again, we had Groove in the Moo, then we had Splendor, now I've got NYE in the Park. Adam, what are your thoughts on this, on government intervention? Because when I think back to COVID and there were obviously calls for support there to keep these venues alive, they were still having to pay their bills, regardless of the fact whether they could have 1 or 10 or 0 shows on that week. They still had to keep going. So there was calls for government support then. It's happening again now. What's your response to that?
So government intervention is righteous in exceptional circumstances. JobKeeper was one of them through COVID. Musicians typically didn't get much support through COVID. It was really difficult because what they did, you know, typically was not classed as a job. As you know, they did tour and play gigs, but it's not like normal employment. But they had to really struggle, you know, through those times. And I think the JobKeeper program was righteous as an exceptional requirement to trade through what was a government mandate to shut down, to lock down. And so I think it's righteous then. But overall, I don't think government support is something that you can rely on for the medium or long term. So if it's a short-term solution to transition from one trading state to another, I think the government can play a role. But it makes me a bit nervous when you start talking about medium or longer-term support, because that tends to just distort the market beyond, I think, its tolerance threshold.
So the Australian Festival Association Managing Director, Mitch Wilson, he came out last week and was the one to call for a government support. This is what he said. Some festivals have seen strong ticket sales this summer, but with costs up 30 to 40% across the board and affordable insurance difficult to obtain, margins are tight. Festival organisers haven't raised ticket prices to offset or meet these increases due to cost of living challenges being faced by everyone. So Adam, as my go-to for really any kind of wisdom, I always say, what would Adam do? We know that cost of living pressure is there. We know that ticket prices are up. whether you agree or disagree that the lineups aren't as strong as recent years. Put that to the side as well. If you don't think government support or intervention is a good long-term solution, what do we do in the short term to help here? Is it a case of, you know, you can always just tell Australians get out there and support Australian music. Sure, but what about the cost of living crisis? What do we do in the short term to help fix this problem?
So in short, Neil, I don't have a single answer. And I think that, you know, there are experts in all these industries who no doubt will come up with many, but to offer just some off-the-cuff ones, you know, I loved going to pub gigs, club gigs, and I think that that is always a good thing. Yeah, and look, festivals came along and they became the big sort of touring beasts that they are, you know, from the Big Day Out through to Splendor in the Grass or Bluesfest, you know. So not all of them have survived, as we know. But if you look at the overall, I think this tends to come down to grassroots nurturing of arts. And I would say that a big part of that is, what are the pathways for people to become bands or become a musical performer through schools, through councils, through local groups, and through local venues, both for smaller performances and for festivals like the Laneway Festival or others, to nurture those groups from getting from, hey, I think I got talent and I'm willing to work hard, to actually having a commercial proposition. And so it's nurturing those on-ramps. If you look at sport, you know, AFL clubs, rugby league clubs, they have their development pathways. Soccer, anything, any sort of major sport across the country, I should say football rather than soccer. But you've got junior through to senior and even professional ranks. There are pathways. And so I think something analogous to that for the arts is something that the government could look at over a long term. You know, there is an Australian Institute of Sport. There is an Australian Institute of Sport. Is there something that we can learn from that in the realm of sport to apply to business, to apply to music, and help nurture those pathways for up-and-coming talent?
I mean, if we're going to try and end this segment on a glass half full approach, we should note that over the Easter long weekend, and you said it before, Adam, that the Bluesfest event went ahead in Byron Bay, and from all reports, incredible success. It was huge attendance, you know, big acts like Jack Johnson, Ben Harper. I think Jimmy Barnes was also there. I think he was meant to take time off because he had heart surgery, but I think he performed. And the Bluesfest founder, Peter Noble, has already come out and said it will absolutely be back in 2025. So there is something there. To your point earlier, that the appetite may have been hindered because of the cost of living crisis, there is still reason to be optimistic, but it really is about now, how do we make sure that filters through? Because again, Bluesfest is not necessarily a younger person's festival, for lack of a better term. It's got some of the older acts. I mean, hey, I love Tom Jones. I'd see Tom Jones in a heartbeat. But would Tom Jones appeal to a 19-year-old? I'm not so sure. But the point is that how do we kind of translate that to the younger crowds? Because, you know, when Splendor in the Grass goes down, that is alarm bells.
Yeah, look, it's significant, isn't it? And speaking to my vintage, I've seen both Ben Harper and Jack Johnson at Bluesfest years ago and loved it. And I'm seeing Tom Jones tomorrow night.
Are you really? I didn't know he was doing sideshows.
Yes.
Okay, well, we're going to have to talk about that after the show. But before we wrap up the show, I don't know if you got to do it last week, Adam. I don't know if you got to do it at the retail summit. Adam's Other Business is back, and I'm so happy about that. So, Adam, give it to us. What is Making Other Business this week?
All right. Just something of a recap and a look forward here. So we know that things are not easy in trading conditions. We've talked about cost of living pressure. We know that interest rates are high at the moment. So where are we now and where are we in the near future? Westpac Melbourne Institute of Consumer Sentiment, the index decreased in March. So people are feeling still very concerned about interest rates and rising living costs. I think that just shows in fact and in data what we believe to be true ourselves. The NAB Monthly Business Survey of Conditions is due for another release soon, but just a few weeks ago, it came out for February, looking back at that. And there was a slightly better index. It rose marginally through better conditions, trading conditions and profitability, but still shows caution. So we've got very cautious consumers, gloomy even, and we've got a cautious business environment. Having said that, we've got property prices at record highs, probably more of a supply issue than just a demand issue, but there's still people are paying record prices for property. And the Australian stock market is near record levels. So we are seeing investors and property do well, even in this environment. And the truth is, of course, all of these are general statistics. And not every industry is doing it tough. Some are doing very well. Not every consumer is doing it tough. Some are doing very well. So it's really about for brand marketers, for our media operators that we speak to every day, for communications and PR, from media buying. It's really around how to taper your message to the circumstances that exist. Looking forward, of course, we know that we've got stage three tax cuts coming in 1 July, not far away now. And we've seen that the RBA minutes came out from their last meeting. They haven't said they've got a bias to raising interest rates. That's good. But nor have they said they've got a bias to lowering them too soon. They are watching the data. So in short, we've got cautious consumers and cautious businesses looking forward to tax cuts and interest rate relief.
You always finish on a high note. And that's the best part about Adam's other business.
Well, it's like Winston Churchill said, you know, I'm going to paraphrase him here. So, you know, I myself am an optimist. I don't see much point in being anything else.
That's a great way to end the show. Adam, thank you so much. And thank you for listening to this week's episode. Before we go, we should plug in, and probably should have mentioned it in the last segment, Adam, that on this week's episode of the One-on-One podcast, I'll be joined by ARIA CEO Annabelle Hurd.
Oh, brilliant.
Annoyingly enough, though, this interview was recorded 3 days before the Splendor stuff happened. So, but we did talk about the things happening in the music festival scene. It was a really good chat with Annabelle. So that'll be out this Friday. But otherwise, that about does it for us this week. So thank you again for listening.
And I want to say a particular thank you to Abe Udy and our friends at Abe's Audio for the edit. They do a great job with their podcast. Get in touch with them at Abe's Audio. Remember to hit follow and visit mumbrella.com.au for more information on everything we've discussed today.